A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel wrote to us about something that's been on his mind. A distant relative passed away a few days ago. Someone who'd put off seeing a doctor for years. In large part, Daniel thinks, out of hostility to Western medicine. He says he can't relate to that part, because he's a proponent of evidence-based medicine. In fact, since moving to Israel, where healthcare is good, he says he simply doesn't bother with supplements. But then he goes somewhere else with it, and this is the part that really lands. He says maybe there's another reason people avoid doctors, something he can relate to. Sometimes you have a physical sensation, or you know something's wrong, but health anxiety spirals you into convincing yourself of the very worst outcome. And then you avoid going to the doctor at all, because you think there's already enough going on in your life, and you'd rather not know. He points out that this is where the cartoon image of health anxiety falls apart, because it's usually played for comedy. The person who thinks every sniffle is cancer and is at the doctor every week. But in actual fact, it can cause people to defer or avoid medical care for very serious, very treatable conditions. And then he lends the key paradox. The first port of call for anxiety and health, anxiety itself, is the medical system, which is the very thing the person is trying to avoid or is phobic about. So his question is, what can help somebody get in the door despite their fears? And what resources are out there for people struggling with this?
That paradox is the whole thing, isn't it? The thing you need is the thing you're terrified of. And Daniel's right. The comedic stereotype gets it exactly backwards. The hypochondriac who's at the doctor every week demanding MRIs, that's the image. But the person who hasn't seen a doctor in 6 years because they're terrified of what they'll find, that person is invisible. Clinically invisible, culturally invisible. And arguably, that's the more dangerous presentation.
So let's start with what health anxiety actually is, because the clinical definition might surprise people. What does the DSM actually say?
The diagnosis is illness anxiety disorder, IAD, and the Mayo Clinic lays out the criteria pretty clearly. You've got a preoccupation with having or acquiring a serious illness, a high level of anxiety about health, and then the person either performs excessive health checking behaviors or avoids medical appointments entirely. Both patterns are diagnostic. Both. That's the part most people miss. The avoidance subtype is right there in the criteria, equal footing with the checking subtype.
So the same diagnosis covers the person who Googles symptoms for 3 hours a night, and the person who won't open a lab result envelope.
Exactly the same box in the DSM. And there's a key distinction from somatic symptom disorder. In somatic symptom disorder, the person has significant physical symptoms that are distressing. The symptoms are real and present. In illness anxiety disorder, the person may have no symptoms at all, or only very mild ones. The pathology isn't the sensation, it's the interpretation of the sensation. A normal bodily event, a headache, a palpitation, a mole that's always been there, gets interpreted as catastrophic. That's the engine.
So the stereotype focuses on overreaction. But the clinical reality includes the person who does nothing, and the nothing is the part that kills you, literally.
Literally. And this is where the avoidance paradox gets its teeth. Let me walk through the cognitive behavioral loop, because once you see it, you can't unsee it. It starts with a normal bodily sensation. Everyone has them. Your heart skips a beat, you get a headache, you notice a mole you hadn't paid attention to before. For most people, it registers and fades. For someone with IAD, that sensation triggers a catastrophic interpretation. Not, huh, I should drink more water. It's, this is a brain tumor. This is a heart condition. This is melanoma. That interpretation generates intense anxiety, genuinely intense, physically felt anxiety. And the natural human response to anxiety is to seek safety. But the person has learned, often through past experiences, that seeking reassurance from doctors leads to temporary relief, followed by renewed anxiety, or worse, that the doctor might confirm the fear. So the person avoids the trigger entirely.
And avoiding it works. In the short term.
That's the negative reinforcement piece. Avoidance reduces anxiety immediately. You don't make the call, the anxiety drops. You cancel the appointment, relief floods in. Your brain learns avoiding doctors equals feeling better. The behavior gets reinforced. And the next time a sensation shows up, the avoidance response is stronger, faster, more automatic. You're training yourself to stay away from the one thing that could actually help you.
It's the same mechanism as any phobia. You avoid the spider, the anxiety goes down, the phobia gets stronger. Except the spider is a building full of people who could catch your cancer at stage one.
Right. And the consequences are measurable. Health anxiety patients who avoid care don't have worse outcomes because they're sicker people. They have worse outcomes because they present later in the disease course. A melanoma that could have been excised in office becomes a stage 3 that requires systemic treatment. Hypertension that could have been managed with a cheap daily pill becomes a stroke. The very mechanism that protects them from short-term anxiety exposes them to long-term risk. It's a trade your brain is making without your consent.
And Daniel's observation about sanitary conditions. I want to sit with that for a second. He used that word specifically, sanitary conditions. Things that are straightforward, treatable, almost boring when caught early. Skin checks, colonoscopies, blood pressure monitoring, routine blood work. These aren't exotic interventions. They're the maintenance schedule for the human body, and health anxiety can make a person defer all of it.
The conditions most feared, cancer, heart disease, neurodegenerative disorders, are precisely the ones where early detection dramatically improves outcomes. A colonoscopy finds a polyp. They snip it out, you're done. No cancer. But if you avoid the colonoscopy for 5 years because you're terrified of what they might find, that polyp becomes a tumor. The fear creates the very outcome it was trying to prevent. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy in slow motion.
Let me give you a concrete scenario. Someone notices a mole changing shape and color. The catastrophic interpretation is melanoma. They think about calling a dermatologist. Their heart rate spikes. They imagine the biopsy, the diagnosis, the treatment, telling their family. They don't make the call. A month passes. The mole changes a little more. Now the anxiety is worse, which makes the avoidance stronger. 18 months go by. They finally go in, maybe because a partner insists, maybe because the mole is now impossible to ignore. It's stage 3 melanoma. The thing they were afraid of happened, and it happened because they were afraid of it.
And here's the other scenario that's equally common. Chest palpitations. Someone feels their heart skip or flutter. Happens to everyone. Premature ventricular contractions, PVCs, totally benign in a structurally normal heart. But this person interprets it as a heart condition. They avoid the cardiologist because they don't want to know. Meanwhile, the anxiety about the palpitations triggers more adrenaline, which causes more palpitations. It's a feedback loop where the fear creates the symptom that reinforces the fear. They could have had a single visit, an EKG, a reassurance that their heart is fine, and been done with it. Instead, they spend 2 years in a state of low-grade terror.
And the medical system itself. I want to talk about why it's uniquely triggering. Because it's not just the fear of bad news, it's the entire sensory experience.
Oh, absolutely. The white coat, the examination table, the blood pressure cuff, the stethoscope. These are conditioned stimuli. If you've had a bad experience, or even if you've just imagined 1,000 bad experiences, those cues trigger an anxiety spike the moment you walk into the waiting room. Your blood pressure reading is elevated, which the doctor notes, which makes you more anxious. The doctor is rushed because most primary care appointments are 15 minutes. You don't feel heard. You leave with your questions unanswered and your anxiety higher than when you arrived. That experience reinforces the belief they'll miss something, or they'll dismiss me, or they'll confirm my worst fear. The system designed to provide care is the phobic stimulus.
15 minutes. That's the standard slot.
15 minutes. And for someone with health anxiety, that's not enough time to even describe what they're feeling, let alone have a doctor respond thoughtfully. So the patient leaves feeling unseen, which confirms their belief that the system can't help them, which strengthens the avoidance. It's a structural problem, not just an individual one.
So we understand the loop. But here's where it gets really interesting, and really frustrating, because the treatment for this condition requires engaging with the very thing you're afraid of.
This is the meta-paradox. The gold standard treatment for illness anxiety disorder is cognitive behavioral therapy, specifically exposure and response prevention adapted for health anxiety. CBT with ERP. It's what the clinical guidelines recommend as first line. But CBT requires you to engage with a therapist, which is itself a form of healthcare. You have to overcome your avoidance of the medical system to get treatment for your avoidance of the medical system. It's a nesting doll of fear.
So how does anyone actually do it?
Let me walk through what the evidence-based treatment pathway actually looks like, because knowing the shape of it can make it less terrifying. First line is CBT with ERP. The exposure part is gradual and hierarchical. This is crucial because people imagine exposure therapy means being thrown into the deep end. It doesn't. You build what's called a fear ladder. The first rung might be looking at a photo of a hospital. The next might be reading an article about a medical condition. Then calling a doctor's office just to ask about appointment availability. Not making one, just asking. Then sitting in a parking lot outside a clinic. Then sitting in a waiting room without an appointment. Then a brief appointment with no examination, just a conversation. Then eventually a full checkup. Each step is practiced until the anxiety comes down. Then you move to the next one.
And the response prevention part. What's being prevented?
The checking and reassurance-seeking behaviors. No Googling symptoms. No asking your partner for the fifth time if they think the mole looks weird. No taking your blood pressure 6 times a day. Those behaviors are the compulsions in this particular flavor of OCD, and health anxiety shares a lot of underlying mechanism with OCD. Intrusive thought, anxiety spike, compulsive behavior to neutralize the anxiety. The treatment principle is the same. Expose yourself to the fear and don't do the compulsion. The anxiety rises and then it falls on its own, and your brain learns that the feared outcome didn't happen.
So the mechanism is the same, which means the evidence base is robust. It's not like we're guessing here. We know this works for OCD, we know it works for panic disorder, and we know it works for health anxiety.
Right, and if CBT isn't enough or isn't accessible, there's a second line option, SSRIs. Fluoxetine and paroxetine specifically have evidence for illness anxiety disorder. They're not a cure, but they can lower the baseline anxiety enough that someone can engage with therapy. And then there's a third line. Mindfulness-based approaches that help patients observe bodily sensations without catastrophic interpretation. The goal there is to notice the sensation, label it as a sensation, and let it pass without spinning up the story about what it means.
Let me give you a case study from the literature, because I think it makes this real. A 45-year-old woman with IAD hadn't seen a doctor in 7 years. 7 years. Treatment involved 12 sessions of ERP. The first exposure was looking at a picture of a hospital. The final exposure was a full physical exam with blood work. She completed it. And they found she had well-controlled hypertension that required medication, a condition that would have been caught years earlier if she'd been going to regular checkups. The thing she was afraid of wasn't cancer or a brain tumor. It was high blood pressure. Manageable, treatable, and it had been quietly damaging her arteries for the better part of a decade.
That's the thing. Most of what gets found in routine checkups is boring. It's not the catastrophic diagnosis your brain has been rehearsing. It's slightly elevated cholesterol. It's a vitamin D deficiency. It's a blood pressure that needs monitoring. But the avoidance doesn't know that. The avoidance only knows the fear.
So let's talk about practical resources. Daniel asks specifically what's out there for people struggling with this. What can someone actually do, starting today?
I want to name specific things. The Mayo Clinic's Illness Anxiety Disorder page has a self-assessment and treatment overview. That's a good starting point for understanding what you're dealing with. The Anxiety and Depression Association of America, the ADAA, has a therapist finder on their website with filters for health anxiety specifically. That's useful because not every therapist knows how to treat this. You want someone who does.
There's a book I want to flag. The Health Anxiety Workbook by Dr. Karen Cassaday, published in 2023. It provides a structured CBT protocol for self-guided work. It walks you through the fear ladder, the exposure exercises, the response prevention. If you can't get to a therapist right now, this is a place to start.
There are also online CBT programs with health anxiety modules. This Way Up, based in Australia, has one. Mood GYM has one. These are structured, evidence-based, and you can do them from home, which matters, because for someone in the avoidance spiral, even leaving the house to see a therapist can feel impossible. Starting with an online program can be the first rung on the ladder.
For Israeli listeners specifically, Daniel mentioned he's in Israel, and a lot of our audience is here. The public health system offers CBT through mental health clinics. Klalit, Maccabi, Meudet, Lumit, all four Kupot Cholim have mental health services, and CBT for anxiety is part of the standard health basket. You need a referral from your family doctor, which is itself the thing you're avoiding, but that's where the strategies we're about to discuss come in.
Let's talk about those strategies. The getting in the door piece. Because Daniel's question is ultimately practical, what can help somebody get in the door despite their fears? I've got four concrete things.
Go.
1. Bring a support person, someone who knows about the anxiety, who can sit with you in the waiting room, who can advocate for you if you freeze up. This isn't weakness, this is scaffolding. The presence of a trusted person lowers the threat response. 2. Use the two-appointment strategy. Schedule a first appointment with no examination, just a conversation. You meet the doctor. You explain that you have health anxiety. You talk about what you're afraid of. That's the whole visit. No stethoscope, no blood pressure cuff, no lab orders. Just a conversation. Then you schedule the actual checkup for a later date. This decouples the doctor visit from the feared outcome.
That's smart. The first visit is a rehearsal. You learn that you can survive being in the room.
3. Write down your fears beforehand and hand the note to the doctor. This bypasses the freeze response. When you're in the moment, your amygdala is screaming and your frontal lobes go offline. You can't articulate what you're afraid of. But you wrote it down at home when you were calmer. Hand over the paper. Let the doctor read it. This also solves the 15-minute problem. The doctor knows immediately what they're dealing with and can use the time effectively.
And 4?
4. Use the fear ladder I described earlier. Start with the least threatening step and don't move on until that step feels manageable. Step 1 might be calling to ask about appointment availability, not making one, just asking. Step 2 might be driving past the clinic. Step 3 might be sitting in the parking lot. Step 4 might be sitting in the waiting room without an appointment. Step 5 is the conversation-only appointment. Step 6 is the actual checkup. You don't jump to step 6. You earn it, one rung at a time.
The goal isn't to eliminate anxiety. I think that's worth saying explicitly. The goal is to act despite it. Anxiety during a doctor's visit is normal for someone with IAD. The question is whether the anxiety gets a veto. The fear ladder trains your brain that the veto isn't automatic.
This connects to something important about reassurance. A lot of people think health anxiety can be solved by reassurance. Just tell the person they're fine, show them the normal test results, and they'll calm down. But reassurance is counterproductive in the long term. It works for about 20 minutes, and then the doubt creeps back in. Did they check the right thing? Did the lab make a mistake? Maybe I need a second opinion. Reassurance seeking is the compulsion, and feeding it just strengthens the cycle. The treatment is learning to tolerate uncertainty. You'll never be 100% certain that you don't have a serious illness. Nobody is. The skill is living with that uncertainty without letting it run your life.
That's a hard sell, by the way. Learn to tolerate uncertainty isn't what someone in a panic spiral wants to hear.
No, it's not. But it's the truth, and the fear ladder makes it possible. You're not tolerating the full uncertainty all at once. You're tolerating a tiny dose, the uncertainty of whether you can look at a picture of a hospital without panicking, and then building from there.
I want to connect this back to something Daniel said about his relative. The relative's hostility to Western medicine and Daniel's own health anxiety avoidance. They look like opposites. One is ideologically opposed to evidence-based medicine. The other believes in it, but can't bring themselves to engage with it. But I wonder if they share a common root. The fear of what you'll find out.
That's a really interesting thought. The stories are different. One says they're all quacks trying to poison you. The other says, I believe in medicine, I just can't face it right now. But the underlying emotion might be the same. Fear of the diagnosis. Fear of the loss of control. Fear of the life-changing information that might come out of that appointment. The relative built an ideology around the fear. Daniel's describing the fear in its raw form. But it's the same fear.
The solution is the same too. Engage with evidence-based care. And if the anxiety is too high to do that directly, engage with evidence-based mental health care first. Treat the avoidance before you treat the thing you're avoiding.
There's a knock-on effect here I want to flag because it matters for how we think about healthcare systems. People with IAD who do seek care often become what emergency departments call frequent flyers. They show up repeatedly with symptoms that turn out to be nothing, driving up costs and straining resources. That's the checking subtype. They're visible, they're expensive, and they're often dismissed as difficult patients. But the avoidance subtype is invisible to the system. They don't show up until they're acutely ill. They're not in the waiting room, they're not in the utilization data, they're not on anyone's radar. Until they're in the emergency department with a stage 4 cancer that should have been caught 5 years ago. That's a blind spot in population health management.
You've got one group that overutilizes and one group that underutilizes, both driven by the same underlying disorder, and the system is designed to handle neither of them well.
Correct. The 15-minute appointment model fails both groups. The frequent flyer needs more time to be heard and a coordinated care plan that doesn't involve bouncing between specialists. The avoider needs an intake process that doesn't trigger a panic attack. Neither of them is getting what they need from a system optimized for throughput.
Let's make this concrete. Here's what you can actually do, starting today.
Three things. First, if you recognize the avoidance pattern in yourself, name it. Health anxiety is a treatable condition, not a character flaw. The avoidance is a symptom, not a choice. You're not weak, you're not irrational, you're not failing. You have a recognized clinical condition with evidence-based treatments. That reframe alone can reduce the shame that keeps people stuck.
Second, build the fear ladder. Write it down. Step 1 through step 6, or however many steps feel right. Start at step 1 today. Not tomorrow. Not when you feel ready. Today. Step 1 is probably something you can do from your phone. Call a clinic and ask about appointment availability. You're not making an appointment. You're just asking a question. Do that today.
Third, for the listener who prompted this episode, Daniel, if you're hearing this, consider that the book I mentioned, The Health Anxiety Workbook, might be a useful starting point. You can work through it at home, at your own pace, without setting foot in a doctor's office. It's not a substitute for medical care, but it can be the bridge that gets you there. And your Kupat Cholam has CBT services. When you're ready, the referral pathway exists.
Where does this leave us? I want to leave you with a question about the system itself.
Go.
What would it look like if healthcare systems designed intake processes specifically for people with health anxiety? Some clinics are experimenting with anxiety-friendly appointments. Longer slots, no surprises, pre-visit questionnaires that ask about health anxiety directly. The patient fills out a form that says, I have health anxiety. Here's what helps me. Here's what makes it worse. The doctor reads it before walking in the room. Is that scalable? Could you build that into every primary care practice without breaking the system?
I don't know if it's scalable at current reimbursement rates. A 20-minute anxiety-friendly slot costs more than a 15-minute standard slot and someone has to pay for it. But the alternative is paying for the stage 4 cancer treatment, or the stroke rehabilitation, or the heart surgery that could have been prevented. The math might work out if you look at total cost of care over 10 years instead of per visit cost this quarter. But that's a reimbursement reform conversation, not a clinical one.
The comedic stereotype of the hypochondriac who's at the doctor every week is almost the opposite of the real problem. The real problem is the person who's not at the doctor at all. If this episode helps one person make one appointment they've been avoiding, it's done its job.
If the treatment requires engaging with the medical system, and the medical system is what the person is phobic about, isn't the whole thing just a catch-22? How does anyone actually break in?
That's exactly the question, Hilbert. And the answer is that you don't break in all at once. You build a ladder where the first rung doesn't involve the medical system at all. A workbook at home. An online CBT module. A phone call where you're just asking a question, not making an appointment. Each rung proves to your brain that you can survive the anxiety, and the next rung becomes possible.
You bring help. A support person. A written note. A strategy. You don't white-knuckle it alone. The catch-22 is real, but it's not absolute. You can approach it gradually, from the edges, until the door doesn't feel like a threat anymore.
Thanks, Hilbert. That's the question we needed.
I keep thinking about that woman who hadn't seen a doctor in 7 years. 12 sessions of ERP and she got through a full physical. The thing she was afraid of was hypertension. Manageable. Treatable. 7 years of avoidable damage because her brain convinced her it was something worse. I wonder how many people are walking around right now in that exact situation, afraid of a monster under the bed when what's actually, there's just a loose floorboard.
If you have a weird prompt, a paradox, a contradiction, a question that keeps you up at night, send it to us. We'll research it, we'll think about it, and we'll make an episode. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.